It was the most devastating call I ever took in my life.
Everybody was just really rigid with shock. It was just too appalling to contemplate.
It was nationally and internationally, worldwide audience wanting to know why this 10-year-old was killed.
I looked at this little boy and thought, that could be my brother, that could be one of my cousins, that could be someone from my family.
The person at the other end just broke the news straight away that, look, Damilola went to school last night, yesterday, and he didn't come back home.
I'm Rav Wilding, TV presenter and former Metropolitan Police officer. The case that affected me most during my time in the Met was that of Damilola Taylor. On the 27th of November 2000, he bled to death in a stairwell after a vicious attack. Now I want to look back over Damilola's story and discover what lessons have been learned since. It was the crime that shocked the nation. 10-year-old Damilola Taylor had only been in the UK for 3 months when he was attacked by a gang of youths, stabbed with a piece of glass and left to die. The investigation cost nearly £16 million, took nearly 6 years and three trials to finally convict Danny and Ricky Preddy with his manslaughter. They both got 8 years each. Damilola's father, Richard Taylor, has become a leading figure in the movement against youth violence since his son's death. He doesn't often speak publicly now about what happened to Damilola, but for this documentary, he's making an exception. Okay, Richard, firstly, thank you so much for talking to us about something so sensitive. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Richard, tell me a little bit about Damilola. What was he like? What did he enjoy? Tell me about him as a boy.
As a young person, you know, Damilola was lovable by everybody. You know, he smiles like you. You can see from his picture that he's always smiling.
Damilola was born in Nigeria on the 7th of December 1989. He had an elder sister, Bemi, and a brother, Tunde.
So he was from childhood, from the day one he was born. I was in the hospital when he was born. He came with a scream. He was screaming, and he was screaming. And he anywhere he is, he wants to be noticed. You know, he wants, because he's doing, you know, good things. He was doing the positive things. You know, he's taking part in activities. He always relates with the elderly people. You know, those who are older than him. I think he's a very old boy. You know, I'm sure. You know, that boy is not. It's not ordinary.
Damilola was raised in Nigeria, but his life was tragically cut short while living in the UK.
And this is where it happened, Peckham in South London. In fact, right here was where those famous CCTV images are from. The name Damilola Taylor strikes a chord with everyone, thinking back of that innocent young boy smiling in that picture. At the time, this was my patch. I was an officer on the beat here, and I loved working here in Peckham, and with all those that lived here. I want to meet someone else who, like me, became involved in the story as part of a day-to-day job. Journalist Joyce O'Harger covered the case from the very beginning and was moved by it. So Joyce, I did 8 years in the Met, and to this day, the case that meant the most to me or had the biggest impact in my working life there was Damilola Taylor's. What did it mean to you and your working life?
Yeah. I mean, it was one of the most harrowing cases I think I've ever covered. I mean, as a journalist, you try to sort of stand back emotionally and try not to get emotionally involved in the cases that you cover. But this one, for some reason, really got to me. I think that's because of his age and the fact that he's Nigerian and that my family's Nigerian. And, you know, and as a mother as well, you know, I've got a young daughter. Because I just think that it was just such a horrible thing to have to cover, and I can't imagine what it would be like for Richard and Gloria Taylor to have gone through.
In the year 2000, Richard was working as a civil servant and living in Nigeria with his family.
We had Damilola 10 years after Tunde, and he was schooling in Nigeria as well as a young lad. While in Nigeria, everything was fine. school was good for the young people, but medical reasons had to make us decide on the movement back to the UK.
So the family made the decision to move to the UK, while Richard remained in Nigeria for work. Damilola found himself living on the North Peckham estate in South London. It was an area of real poverty, with over half the residents earning less than £150 a week, compared to the national average of £418. Youth crime in Peckham had increased by 40% in just 1 year, and children as young as 8 were joining the gangs that were now dominating the area.
He came over here with his family because of his sister, and I think, you know, they expected life to be good, but they also had a good life in Nigeria. So I think this would have been the last thing that they would have expected. I wouldn't imagine that they thought they would end up living on the North Peckham estate, but so it was probably a bit of a culture shock for them, because it wasn't a poor family coming here thinking, oh, you know, this is going to be the most amazing experience.
In Peckham, Damilola was doing well at school. He was a good goalkeeper, and that helped him to fit in with his new classmates.
So you're at home in Nigeria, and you're having daily conversations with Gloria, your wife, and you're hearing good things about Damilola's schooling and how much he's enjoying it.
Yes, I was, because every time I called him, he was very happy that he was enjoying it. He told me he has become a prefect. He decided that he was going to stay back, you know, with his brother and the sister and the mother, because I was saying, okay, let him come back after 3 months, you know. So he said, no, he's going to stay back and have his education here, because he felt that there are more advantage here. It's more advantageous for him to, you know, because he was saying, you know, he's using the computer in the library, and he was very, you know, keen to continue, you know, using, because back in Nigeria, he hardly had opportunity to use the internet. So he was enthused by that, you know, that he wants to remain here.
In Nigerian community, that's education is everything. Because he was probably so studious and so into his education, we were told that he was bullied a bit by some of the other students. Because, you know, if you're Nigerian and you're really focused on your education, and other children aren't that interested, then that makes you a target. And so, possibly, that's why he was targeted by these youths. So he was just a young boy just doing what any Nigerian child would be doing.
The first 2 months, you know, was good, you know, because the conversation we usually have, there was no problem. Until, I think, what happened was when he started using the library, because instead of going home at daylight, you know, going to the library, it will have become dark to go home. And that's where the problem started, you know, and you know, young people of his age started talking to him. You know, they wanted him to be part of their group, maybe gang. So that's where the problem started, because you know, those bad boys in Peckham, they were on the street, you know, harassing and intimidating the newcomers.
After a normal day at school on the 27th of November 2000, Damilola attended an after-school computer club at the local library. When he left, it was dark outside, and Damilola began what was to be his final journey home.
The events after Damilola left school have been difficult to prove. That's why it took 3 court cases to eventually convict the Preddy brothers of his manslaughter. Mark Williams-Thomas is a criminologist and former detective specialising in child cases.
Hi, Rav.
Mark, good morning. Now, this is where he died. This is completely changed beyond all recognition, but that was a massive estate over there. There was a derelict stairwell, and that's where that poor kid lost his life. We know where he died, but what happened before that?
Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult to imagine, isn't it, as the scene was then. Some of the places still exist. Obviously, his school, which is just up around the corner, and the library. And what we do know is that he left the school, he went to the library to use the computers, and then he left the library, and it was from the library that he came home. Usual route, which is literally, you know, a couple of minutes walk from down there. And obviously, as he left the library, he thought he'd be home in a few minutes and he'd be able to carry on his life.
These are CCTV images of Damilola playing outside the library before going in to attend an after-school club. He then left the library, taking his usual route home. Walking along Blake's Road, Damilola was 400 yards from his home when he was stopped and surrounded by a teenage gang. Police believe they tried to steal Damilola's silver jacket. When he refused to hand it over, they stabbed him in the leg using a broken bottle.
And the attack happened in one place, but he actually staggered on from there, didn't he? Because he didn't actually die where he was attacked.
No, well, of course, when you get injured to the degree that he was stabbed by a bottle, the impact was of such that he was bleeding to death, but he didn't result in immediate death, so that there was a small time period for him to then try and gain attention from somebody. And that's clearly what he was going. He was going to try and find somebody.
The gang of youths had left 10-year-old Damilola alone to bleed to death.
Little did he know what he was going to suffer, and in fact what Peckham was going to suffer, and how that legacy was going to be left.
It's 10 years since Damilola Taylor died alone on this Peckham estate. It was a tragedy at the time that shook the nation.
It was on the 27th of November 2000 when, on his way home from the library, Damilola was attacked by a teenage gang. They stabbed him with a broken bottle and ran away, not knowing what condition Damilola was in.
Now, the reason for the attack we don't entirely know, but it could well have been robbery, wanting to steal an item that he had. He was stabbed. He then tried to recover himself. He got up and he walked up a stairwell, but he was losing an awful lot of blood at this stage. And then he collapsed at the top of this stairwell. And it was at that point that a member of the public, who happened to be a carpenter from nearby, came to the rescue and actually followed the trail of blood up to where Damilola lay at the top of the stairwell. He obviously saw that Damilola was in a very critical stage. So he phoned 3 nines, phoned for the emergency services, and the emergency services attended.
Damilola collapsed into the arms of the stranger. His last words were of reassurance, saying, "I'm okay."
Yeah, can you send an ambulance to Blake's Road?
Blake's Road?
Road.
Yeah, what was the area?
Off South Anton Way, SE15.
SE15?
Yeah, SE15, yeah. It's a boy bleeding to death. Right. It's actually bleeding to death. This boy is approximately about 12 years of age.
He has lost
a hell of a lot of blood.
Yeah. How has he done that? What's happened?
We do not know, sir. We've just come out and found him on the staircase. He's tried to climb up.
Right, where's he bleeding from?
He's going. He's in a real
Where's he bleeding from?
We cannot tell.
The ambulance rushed Damilola to hospital, but despite the best efforts of the medical team, he was pronounced dead at 5:47 p.m. The bottle had severed his femoral artery. He'd lost too much blood to survive. After starting to wonder where Damilola was, Mum Gloria had retraced his journey home from school. When she reached Blake's Road, she came upon the police cordon. She was told that a young boy had been attacked. Gloria knew at once that this boy must be her missing son. Richard was contacted at work in Nigeria.
There was a phone call that came directly into the director's office asking for Mr. Taylor. So I was wondering who should be calling me to the director's office. So they said there's an international call. You know, why didn't they call me to my office? So they said, no, this is something, you know, urgent that I should take it. Then I went on the phone and took the call. It was the most devastating call I ever took in my life, because the person at the other end just broke the news straight away that, look, Damilola went to school yesterday and he didn't come back home. He was stabbed, and by the time he was taken to the hospital, he was dead. Then everything that happened after that, I couldn't remember. I think I collapsed. So I was taken to the medical center in the Department of Health there, and I was treated for shock.
So you made your way to the UK as fast as you possibly could. Bearing in mind you had to come all the way from Nigeria. What happened when you first got here?
So I got here, and the the scene was so disturbing. You know, what I came to meet here was a lot of media coverage, a lot of sympathizers, you know, something that I couldn't cope with. So I just decided that I want to be left alone, you know, that I should just get grips of what really happened and what the police are doing. I was reassured that everything will be done, you know, to make sure they get hold of, they arrest the culprits and, you know, get justice done.
MP Harriet Harman has represented Peckham for nearly 30 years. This is her constituency, and she knows the area better than most. Perhaps you can tell us about how you first got involved in this tragic case.
Well, I remember my constituency assistant called me, and then very quickly a number of people who lived in the North Peckham area called me and said there'd been this terrible crime had taken place. And people were saying, you know, a 10-year-old boy has been killed, but almost as they said it, they kind of couldn't believe that it wouldn't be, you know, wrong information. You know, that's what's being said, but that can't possibly have happened. So there was kind of dismay and worry, but almost disbelief. And then when everybody came to realise that that's actually what would happened, people were just really just shocked, really, and then just appalled. And it just created a huge wave of emotion in the local community.
Now, you actually went down physically yourself to the scene to find out what was going on, didn't you?
Well, somebody who was active in the local tenants association had been somebody who'd called me, and so I went down to meet her, and she took me to meet Damilola's great aunt who lived nearby on the estate, and I went in to find out what had happened, and Gloria was there, and of course Richard was still in Nigeria at the time, and everybody was just really rigid with shock. It was just too appalling to contemplate.
I remember when this happened 10 years ago, I was up there in Peckham Police Station, and I went up to the canteen, and it was just so quiet, and there was these people that was the life and soul of the party ordinarily, who didn't even say a word. These are hardened officers who see almost everything here in Peckham because it's such a busy ground, but it was just such a different eerie feeling in that nick because of what they'd seen or even heard about that poor little boy.
I'd only been in the Met for 10 months and I felt shocked, angered and upset. I just couldn't believe that someone could do that to a 10-year-old boy. And like every other officer, I wanted to find the culprits.
The police needed to be able to secure the crime scene, and they needed to be able to clear out the evidence from below. So in other words, everything around them, they needed to make sure that that was secured, whether that be CCTV, and of course that's improved massively now, to make sure that there was anything else left. Sometimes perhaps offenders bring things to the location with them, so there may well have been something left by them. And also to try to establish what the pattern was and what the timeline, and timeline is really important when you're looking at a crime.
One of the key things I became involved in as a police officer were door-to-door inquiries, but relations were difficult between the police and the public. The previous year, an inquiry into the murder of 18-year-old Stephen Lawrence had called the Metropolitan Police institutionally racist. I felt the tensions walking the beat in Peckham.
And of course, it was so difficult for police to get anyone to come forward. What I found was two distinct types of people. You had those that just didn't want to know, wouldn't talk to police, yet you had the others that had come over years before in the 60s from the West Indies or Africa or something, and that was their home, and that was their community, and they couldn't do enough for us. They were so helpful, and there's no middle ground.
No.
And I found that so frustrating, that there were so many people that just didn't want to help.
And they, I'm sure they used to open the door and shut the door in your face and say, look, I'm not prepared to tell you anything. All those ones that, you know, you find out yourself, I won't help you. And the problem is when you're living with that, it's like, well, who's going to come forward and talk? Who's going to give me some evidence? Because they know what the ramifications that are. They know that if they give evidence, that requires statement taking, it may well require identity parade, it certainly will require, if their evidence is believed, going to court and having to give evidence in court. That is massive, and not something that happens overnight. It takes months, sometimes even years, to get to court.
Well, I think that people felt that it would be very difficult to get the people brought to trial, because the people who knew information might be fearful of giving that information, fearful of retribution, fearful that they themselves might come under attack. So I think that it wasn't any sense in which the community was going to be showing solidarity with the killers. It was just that people who might have known things might be afraid that they would have retribution.
In the first few weeks, the police arrested and released 11 different people. There was not enough evidence to charge them, and the officers were facing a wall of silence. At the time, Anthony Phillips was a reporter working for the local paper.
Did you start talking to the local community? What sort of reaction did you get from them?
A lot of people didn't know exactly what had happened, so there were rumours going around. People were angry at what they heard, but also quite scared.
There was just everything going on there, wasn't it? And it was so hard. But I see in your paper here, pretty early on, you actually covered it as soon as the story happened. And then the first headline is why, and I guess that's what the locals were asking. Why would this happen to such a young boy?
Yeah, I mean, that's the area of Southwark has its fair share of violent crime, and for something like this to happen to such a young child at the time was quite unusual. So that really was the question. What happened? Why would someone do that to a 10-year-old boy?
In the following weeks, the media continued to scrutinise the police investigation. But for the Taylor family themselves, the loss of their beloved son had barely started to sink in.
And it was only days afterwards that there was this big memorial service that was held on what would have been his
11th birthday. Memorial service was organized by the church where Gloria was attending that time with the children, you know. So yeah, it was well attended, you know. But still, I still think I was in a state of shock. I don't even know that the service was going on, you know. I couldn't say a word.
Damilola's elder brother, Tunde, spoke on behalf of the family.
My life can never be the same without you again. I have always wanted a brother to be there with me, that I could ask a question, and he could ask questions from me too. Share each other's things, and above all, someone I can proudly call my brother.
You say you don't even remember much about it because you were probably in a state of shock. This is just days after this most tragic incident had happened. How was it for you that you were in the public eye so much at such a tough time?
Well, I didn't even realise I was in the public eye because I was just living like a ghost.
The Taylor family were in a state of shock while the police investigated the highest profile case of the time. I'm Rav Wilding, and I'm re-examining the case of Damilola Taylor. It was a tragedy that stunned us all. 10-year-old Damilola died after being stabbed by a broken bottle on his way home from the library. This shocking crime was making the news all over the world.
Police are still trying to discover the details of Damilola's final journey from the library here. Which route did he take towards his home, less than half a mile away?
Day 6 of the investigation into Damilola Taylor's murder and a new development, possibly a breakthrough, for the 60-strong police inquiry team.
We all feel like we've lost a son. Many people know the family.
That tragedy is one which must touch and affect us all.
As he lay here, bleeding to death. Joey Jones, Sky News, Peckham in South London.
So even though you're the local MP, this was, of course, a national crime, and it was all over the national press. How did that make you feel?
Well, I felt in two minds about it, because on the one hand, you don't want the area that people are living in to be known, to become a byword for such a terrible crime involving the death of such a young boy. But on the other hand, you wouldn't want to feel that a young boy had been killed and nobody cared about it. The stain that came over Peckham because of that was quite hard for people to bear.
Now, just over there, beyond that purple barrier, used to be a huge, great estate.
And just after this incident happened, officers like me were posted on Operation Seal. Now what that was, it was a high profile, high visibility patrol where I would wander down those estates and all around here to reassure the public that it wasn't all bad, trying to get information about what happened to Damalola. But it was a tough time. There was graffiti all over these blocks back then, but this time it was saying things like RIP, rest in peace. And it was like people were trying to help. We just had to break down the barriers to get the information out from them.
Now, of course, there's mounting pressure for this case to be solved, isn't there?
There's huge pressure. Any senior investigating officer, that's a person appointed by the police to oversee the investigation, is under pressure from day one from senior officers. And they would have been saying, right, to get this case solved, have you got any witnesses? Have you got any suspects in relation to this? And that puts considerable pressure. And of course, that pressure then goes down the scale, right from the very top of the senior investigating officer all the way down the troops.
8 months after he died, on the 26th of June 2001, four youths were charged with Damalola's murder. This was largely due to eyewitness testimony provided by a young witness. She claimed to be here on Blake's Road when it happened.
This 14-year-old girl gave them some real key evidence and gave them some direct evidence. And by direct evidence, I mean she actually saw offenders. So it wasn't something that she'd heard. She was told by somebody else. She actually says, I saw the offenders commit this act and I saw them run away. And at that point, she gave a number of names to the police. And it was those names that the police then started to act upon.
When you finally got told that some people had been arrested and charged, and the case was going to trial, how did that make you feel?
Well, we sighed a breath of pleasure, you know, that at last something is, they are making a breakthrough. At least if we are able to get conviction, you know, and see the case through, you know, we will be very happy to, you know, carry on with that.
On the 30th of January 2002, the trial began, and Joyce O'Harger was reporting for London's TV News.
I covered that case virtually every day for 3 months, and it was probably the most harrowing trial I've had to go through. I wanted to see justice done, like everybody else did. I think, you know, it was a 10-year-old boy who was murdered, but also the people who were put on trial for his murder were also children as well. And one of the things that I noticed when, right at the beginning of the case, when there were four youths who were on trial for his murder, they didn't seem to take it that seriously. I think it was as if they were sort of away from school on a day out and hadn't quite understood the seriousness of why they were there, and that this was a court of law, and that there was a young boy had died, and that they could be convicted of murder.
The trial relied heavily on the prosecution's key witness, the 14-year-old girl.
Her evidence was fundamentally flawed. And it was flawed on the basis that there was inducement, as could be seen as her giving evidence. And that inducement, first of all, related to a £50,000 possible reward that was on offer for her. She was given mobile phones, she was given clothes by the investigating officers. And the problem is as soon as you start to give things to a witness, it's very easy for the defence to turn around and say that was an inducement. The reason you gave this was because you were enjoying that lifestyle, and that's the evidence you gave. So it may well have been her evidence was correct, or it may well have been parts of her evidence were correct. That was never going to come through with the way that she was handled by the police.
She was just a typical teenager. So, you know, she was quite streetwise and a bit mouthy, and she just didn't like the way she was being questioned by the defence. She changed her story several times. She admitted lying to the police in the interviews and just kept changing things around. And so at the end of it, the judge decided that she was an unreliable witness.
The police were accused of offering gifts for evidence. And on the 27th of February 2002, Judge Justice Hooper ruled that the witness was lying.
When the judge said her testimony was unreliable, you thought, yeah, it was. That was terrible. But when the case collapsed effectively as a result of that, you know, it's you think, okay, you sort of expected it, but it doesn't make it any better.
Did you think then that's it? Did you think that was the end, or were you hoping that the police would carry on?
No,
with
we couldn't accept that verdict, you know, because we knew right from the beginning that the police had the evidence to prosecute and get a sentence for the killers. I told the solicitor that, look, we need to do, you know, go back to the police and tell them that we are not pleased And that was what we did.
The trial ended with a not guilty verdict for all four defendants. The public were dismayed that these mistakes had led to the collapse of the case. The investigation remained open and the police were determined to see justice served.
Even though the investigation and trial was painful, it had kept Damilola's parents, Richard and Gloria, in the public eye. A year after his death, the Damilola Taylor Trust was launched right here in London.
Having read and saw what the situation in Peckham was with young people and the story behind the young people that had formed themselves into gangs, young people being taken away from parents, you know, by the social services and ending up in secured homes. Those stories were stories that made me to think that a lot has to be done, you know.
As the years passed and the investigation continued, the Damilola Taylor Trust gave Richard and Gloria a positive focus.
I mean, some people you see, they campaign for the death penalty, they campaign for more draconian laws, but Richard Taylor argued that young people who get involved in crime are themselves victims of terrible upbringing, and if support can be given to them, then that can make their lives better as well as protect people who otherwise might be victims of their crime. So I think it was a very remarkable approach he took, really.
The Trust has supported many young people in achieving their goals, offering practical help and advice where otherwise it may have been lacking.
My own wish is to give, if I am in a position for the rest of my life, those young people to, you know, give them the opportunity which Damilola has been deprived of, you know, what Damilola cannot achieve, they can, you know, achieve through our help.
Meanwhile, the police were re-examining vital leads missed in the original investigation.
All I can say at the moment is that three people this morning were arrested in connection with Damilola Taylor's murder. They're being held in a police station in South London. I think what people need to understand is, in relation to inquiries such as this, we, the Metropolitan Police, never give up.
Two of those charged are brothers, aged 16 and 17. Because of their age, they can't be named. The third is a young man of 19. He's been named by police as Hassan Jihad.
In January 2005, just over 4 years after Damilola's death, the three suspects were charged. None of them had been tried for Damilola's murder before. However, all three had been originally arrested in the first few weeks of the investigation in December 2000 and released without charge.
The new senior investigation officer came in and said, let's look at this in a completely new way. Let's use a new fresh pair of eyes to look at this. And what he did is he sent the forensic evidence to an external laboratory and he asked them to look at it. And that's where the evidence came from, because what they found is they found some blood splatter on the trainer and they also found some other items in relation to clothing, and some cross-examination on that showed some fibre exchange. They were starting to build evidence from DNA in relation to a match between the victim, Damilola, and the potential suspects, offenders, on their shoe. And there was now a point where they needed to explain, how did that blood splatter transfer from body to shoe if they were not at the location?
The trial wasn't straightforward. The rest of the evidence was largely circumstantial, and there was now no eyewitness. The prosecution put forward people who claimed that the brothers had made confessions to them, but their testimony came apart under cross-examination. The jurors were even told by a medical expert that Damilola's death could have been an accident. On the 3rd of April 2006, Hassan Jihad was cleared of all charges. The next day, the brothers were cleared of murder, but the jury were unable to reach a verdict on manslaughter.
It was frustrating with the second trial because, you know, you wanted it to end, you wanted closure. And then when that didn't happen, you thought, OK, right, is this ever going to be resolved? Are they ever going to find the killers of Damilola Taylor?
I'm Rav Wilding. 10 years ago, I worked on the case of Damilola Taylor. This investigation affected me more than any others I dealt with during my time in the Met.
Damilola died after being stabbed in the leg with a piece of glass. By 2006, his parents, Richard and Gloria, had sat in court and watched two trials collapse. a third trial was about to start. As the years went by, the area of Peckham, my old patch, was starting to change. The stairwell and block of flats where Damilola had died was knocked down, and the spotlight Damilola's death placed on Peckham helped speed up the planned regeneration of the area.
Now, it's been some time, a few years in fact, since I've spent any significant length of time here in Peckham, especially the North Peckham estate, and it looks to have changed beyond almost all recognition. And for me, it looks like it's changed definitely for the better. What's your views on it now?
Oh, it completely has changed for the better. I mean, when I held weekly advice surgeries, when people come in and see me, if they would sit down in front of me and I'd say, what's your address? And they'd give an address on the North Peckham estate, I'd know exactly what they were going to be saying next. I want to get out. I can't bear it there anymore. Now, if anybody gives me an address in that area, they're not asking to get out at all. It's completely transformed.
So this is all part of my old area now, and a lot of it's changed quite significantly since I was here. This is all new. That's completely new, that. It used to be so different around here. I mean, for example, these buildings here used to be lots of tiny, tiny little bedsits. It was dark and it was dingy and it was crime-ridden. And I think now, with the amount of building that's going on, it just looks so much better. It just feels nicer. It feels a more pleasant place to be. We're just coming up to the Peckham Pulse now, which is also the library, just over here. You can see it just over there now. And that's the forecourt that you've seen on camera. That's it, you'll see it on CCTV. That's just where he was playing in it. And it is so sad because he was playing there after finishing school and doing some work in that library, doing his homework, and then just walking through those alleyways just down there. Within a couple of minutes, he was at Blake's Road. And of course, that's where it all ended.
I'm so pleased to see how much Peckham has changed. And it's not just been a physical regeneration. I'm going to meet three people who grew up in the area, and they're all called young advisors. They're employed by the council to help other young people achieve their goals.
Okay, Emmanuel, Steph and Jackie, you're all young advisors. Tell us, what's a young advisor then?
Well, young advisors are all about youth engagement, so anything to do with helping youths get more engaged in their own environment, helping them in their personal lives, or helping them, you know, just feel engaged and not, you know, pushed out or isolated. That's what we're all about. So whether it's working directly with young people, maybe helping them to set up a youth club, or helping them, signposting them to positive activities within Southwark.
Ever since I was 18, 19, always looking for something to do. We're seeing a lot of young people my age or younger doing things that I thought it wasn't really what they should be doing. And as a young person, I felt that I should do something to help them. There's a lot out there for young people to do, and they're not actually seeing that.
It was two young men who grew up on the North Peckham estate that were in court now accused of killing Damilola. The third trial began on the 23rd of June 2006. The two defendants were both over 18 now and could be named as brothers Danny and Ricky Preddy. After previously being acquitted of murder, they were about to face a trial for manslaughter.
In a simplistic way, the difference between murder and manslaughter is the attitude and the intent to do it. So if I were to kill somebody and I turned up at the location with a knife, with the intention of killing that individual, or I was reckless as to do so, but I still intended I'd form that basis of it prior to attending, then that could be a murder charge. But on the manslaughter is when they get to the location, they didn't intend to kill them, they may have intended to rob them from something. But as a result of the actions that they carried out, the individual died, then that could form the basis of a manslaughter. And that's what the view was, because there was never any evidence given both by the prosecution or the defence that the bottle was taken to the crime scene. It was believed that the bottle was found at the crime scene, and that was what was used to commit the killing.
On the 9th of August 2006, Danny and Ricky Preddy were convicted of manslaughter and sentenced to 8 years each. When the verdict was read out, Ricky started shouting at the jury from the dock. Ricky was 13 and Danny 12 when they killed Damilola, and were believed to have been members of the younger Peckham Boys gang. Even then, both brothers were under supervision and facing charges for robbery and assault.
It's not going to bring you back?
No.
But how did it make you feel when you finally heard those words, guilty?
Well, you just said it, that the conviction is not going to bring back the life of, But my belief or our wish had been met, you know, to at least have a conviction. And, it enabled us to have a rest of mind about who did it.
I remember in August 2006 finally hearing that on the third go, the two killers of Damilola were finally convicted. Ricky and Danny Preddy, people that I'd met during my time in the police, and I remember feeling some sort of pride for the officers that worked for 6 years on this case, leaving no stone unturned, feeling a sense of relief for the community, knowing that the killers had finally been caught. And I remember feeling some sort of sense of closure, at least, for the family of Damilola.
Richard, this documentary is being made because it's 10 years now since this happened. If anything, what lessons have been learned since then?
Oh, well, the lessons have been of various forms, you know. For me, I have learned a lesson. You know, it's not a regret that I agreed that Damilola Lazarus come and have his education here. It's not a regret, but I think that's destiny. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's a lesson. The other lesson, you know, which I'm going to mention here for the first time, is the lesson that the Home Office have learned about the way and manner the investigation was conducted. The forensic evidence was neglected initially, and that contributed a lot and elongated the process of getting conviction.
A lot of lessons were learned, certainly in the way of dealing with witnesses. You know, the first 14-year-old girl was handled terribly badly. You know, a lot of lessons were learned from that. There's a lot of lessons now being learned in relation to dealing with vulnerable witnesses, and we've seen that in recent court trials.
The police have now sat up to really carry out the investigation in the way it has to be done.
The name Damilola still resonates across the UK. We think of the smiling boy who wanted to be a doctor, bleeding to death after a vicious attack.
Where we have to go through the sadness of somebody dying, something very serious happens, we must make sure we learn lessons. And I have to say, from the Damilola's death, you know, very, very sad as it is and shocking, but as a community, an awful lot has been done to move forward from that and to try to make sure it doesn't happen again. And certainly when it does happen, and if it does happen, things aren't dealt with in the same way as they were back then.
One of the things that it did is it very much brought local communities together. There was a Nigerian woman called Kemi, and I remember her saying at a church service to remember Damilola. You know, Damilola was a young Nigerian boy, but he could have been an English boy, he could have been a Jamaican boy, he could have been a Turkish boy. We all have lost a son. And that was the sort of feeling that there was. It was awful.
Nearly 2 years after she saw the killers of her son brought to justice, Gloria Taylor sadly passed away on April the 8th, 2008. But Richard and Gloria's good work continues. The Damilola Taylor Trust has inspired the Spirit of London Awards, now an annual event that aims to highlight the young people making an outstanding contribution to the community.
It's an awards ceremony set up for young people, by young people, so we help sort of organise it. And it's basically, instead of sort of focusing on the negative points about young people, the negative things that happen amongst young people, we're sort of celebrating the positive stuff that they do within our community. So we do offer awards for like achievement through sport, through music, through arts. So whatever young people are interested in, whatever they excel at, we sort of want to make them feel special for a day. So it's like a red carpet event.
There's so many good things that young people do. It's just not highlighted. All you see is the bad things. And if something like this can influence a young person to continue doing what they're doing, which is good, then that would be great.
So with all this brilliant work that you do now, what would Damilola think of everything that you're doing?
Oh, well, you know, the young man will be watching wherever he is, you know, that this has been his wish, you know, because from the poem he wrote that he was going to change the world, that it is his wish to change the world, and he will want to do it in his lifetime. Now maybe this is the form of change he wanted to bring into the world, but he wasn't going to physically do it. No, he has come, lead his life for it to be used, you know, for people to achieve. For me, I think he will be there watching and be happy that his wish has been met.
It took just a piece of glass to end this little boy's life in the most unimaginable way. I set out to find what lessons have been learned since, and it seems many have, with the community where it happened, with the public in general, and with the police. Everyone I've met has been affected by Damilola's case in some way. But for me, the overriding legacy of this young boy's life is the positive image that's now being used to help other young people. Damilola's wish was for a safe and peaceful world. I think that's a lesson we all need to learn.